For years, Tainter Lake and Lake Manoamin in Dunn County have been plagued by massive summer blooms of blue-green algae. It's gross, it smells, it's hazardous to humans, and has been known to kill smaller animals like dogs. That ingest too much of it. But recently, the U.S. Department of Environmental Protection, or the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, has approved a plan by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources that claims to have a solution. And it has to do with excess nutrients getting into the Red Cedar River, which then flow into these man-made lakes. But even though the plan is there, complete with more than a decade of science, moving beyond paper and into implementation is a tricky thing. This hour on the West Side, we talk about the causes of algae blooms, the causes of excess nutrients, and the plan that aims to bring water quality back in line. I'm Rich Kramer. This is the West Side. I'm joined this hour by three people that have worked with the study and are now working to implement and educate people about how to reduce excess nutrients and unsightly algae in lakes Manoamin and Tainter. I'm joined in studio by DNR Wastewater Field Supervisor Paul Liberty. And Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
And next, I'd like to introduce our second guest in studio. I'm talking about Dan Zurr. And Dan is the Regional Natural Resources Educator with UW Extension. Dan Zurr, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks for having us.
And joining us by phone is Watershed Council Coordinator Julia Olmsted. She also works with UW Extension. And Julia, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And as always, I want our listeners to take part in the discussion as well. Do you live around either of these lakes, Manoamin or Tainter? Have you experienced the algae blooms, and how have they affected your life? And what do you think about the efforts to reduce the problem so far? And can we even fix it at all? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615 to get on the West Side. I've also included a couple of links on the West Side Facebook page, including a UW Stout page that talks about the Red Cedar and an upcoming conference that we're going to be talking about here later on in the hour. And also a wonderful page put out by UW Extension that really explains this whole complex thing in very, very easy to understand terms. So while you're listening, if you're near a computer, check it out. Go to Facebook and type in The West Side. Now, we're talking about excess nutrients and phosphorus. And Dan Zurr, I'd like to start with you. How long has this been a problem for the Red Cedar River and Tainter Lake and Lake Manoamin? And what's the nature of what we're dealing with here?
Well, it's been a problem for many decades. But way back in the 70s, the EPA was already studying some of the issues that were going on with these lakes. And Paul will comment a little bit later on some of the research that's been done and some of the finer points of the what we know about the amount of phosphorus and the amount of algae that are in these lakes. But I thought maybe we'd back up a little bit and talk about phosphorus in general. The problem is algae. The algae blooms cause all kinds of issues, smell, unsightliness. Nobody wants to swim in that kind of stuff. There are health issues, people that are sensitive to some of the gases that are off put by these organisms, these algae and cyanobacteria, can often put off ammonia gas and hydrogen sulfide gas, which in large quantities is pretty tough to breathe. So there are all kinds of issues related to the algae, but the algae wouldn't be there if they didn't have anything to eat. And what the algae generally feed on is nitrogen and phosphorus. And phosphorus is kind of the limiting factor in the freshwater systems that we have here in Wisconsin. So our method of trying to do something about this problem is to try to control the amount of phosphorus that's going into these lakes via the rivers that feed them, because both Tainter and Manoamin lakes are basically dammed up portions of the Red Cedar River. They're not natural seepage lakes like we have up in the northern part of Wisconsin, where you've got spring-fed lakes that are groundwater-fed and are usually a lot cleaner. These are you're taking a flowing river system and you're stopping it, and you're letting everything kind of sit in there and cook for a little bit, and the sediment settles out in the bottom of these lakes, and it's a good food supply for the algae. So what we're trying to do with all the efforts that we're undertaking and things that we plan to do in the future is control the amount of phosphorus that's going into these lakes. And that will in turn reduce not just the intensity of the algae blooms, but the frequency as well.
And Paul Liberty, this is a naturally occurring thing, this blue-green algae. It's supposed to happen in some form or another, is it not?
Well, algae in lakes certainly is a natural phenomenon. Blue-green algae are special. They are an algae that floats up near the surface, and they exploit high nutrient environments. When we're in a lower nutrient, lower phosphorus lake, we typically don't see much blue-green algae. We see other kinds of algae which participate in the food chain. They feed the small minnows, and feed the zooplankton, the little shrimps and things in there.
Mm-hmm.
Blue-green algae are pretty impalatable to most of the food chain. So they produce toxins. They really mess up the food chain, and they're an indicator of an unbalanced system.
And you mentioned, Dan Zur, that this has been going on since the 70s. I mean, how long has it been since the algae blooms have gotten so bad that it's caused people to kind of abandon the lakes in the summer?
Well, I think people that live at the lake and have lived there for a while could probably tell you more than I could. But I know that just in probably the last 20 or 30 years, it's gotten considerably worse. There used to be a lot more recreation, a lot more opportunities for recreation on these lakes. There were more marinas. There were more bait shops back then. And those have slowly decreased as people have used these lakes less and less because of the intensity of the algae blooms.
And what kind of impacts? You just mentioned less the tackle shop or less fishing. I mean, I imagine there's got to be some economic impacts for the cities like Menominee that are right, you know, basically hugging this situation.
Definitely, if you have a really attractive natural resource amenity in your neighborhood, like a clean lake or a nice river, it's going to bring people in. It's going to bring people in who want to fish, who want to swim, who want a boat, canoe, kayak, whatever it happens to be. Just the scenic viewing, just sitting on the shores of the lake and looking out at the pretty, the scenic beauty of a nice clean lake. All those things bring people in, and when you start to see a loss of water quality, you start to see a loss of recreation and use of the lake. And we also start to see a loss of property values. Russ Cashian, who's also an extension employee, works at UW-Whitewater, did an economic study of property values along the lakes in the Red Cedar chain. And basically, he kind of looked at the lakes farther north in the Red Cedar Basin, which extends all the way up into Washburn County, northern Barron County up in that area. And the property values for the lakes up there, because the water quality is better, the property values were considerably higher. A couple of numbers, Red Cedar Lake, which is pretty far north in the watershed, on the average frontage property is worth about $1,300 a linear foot along the lake. $1,300. You get down to Taner Lake and it's $400. Mm. You get down to Menominee and it's about $150. So you can see that there's a property value correlation between the water quality and the price of lakefront property. And a lot of people at Taner and Menominee will testify to that their houses aren't worth what they used to be if they bought them, 30 or 40 years ago.
And for our listeners, if you do happen to live along one of these lakes, either Lake Taner or Taner Lake or Lake Menominee, give us a call and let us know. I'm also interested to hear any stories from people who may have remembered back when, the beaches were full and when people were out fishing and swimming. Give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615. Maybe this is an oversimplified question or solution possibly, but Paul Liberty, why don't we just get rid of the dams? I mean, would that take care of the problem? We wouldn't have any blooms then, would we?
Well, it's true. That is a solution to remove the dams. You probably wouldn't grow the algae because the water wouldn't be slowed down. But flowages like Tainter and Monoman create a tremendous recreational opportunity. There aren't a whole lot of natural lakes in the counties around here, so the man-made lakes, Tainter, Monoman, Lake Wasota, Eau Claire Lake, Altoona Lake, are just hotbeds of recreation. And without the dams, those opportunities would all be gone.
Mm. And just, you know, on the top of my head, I'm thinking, why don't we have this problem with Lake Wasota? Or do we?
Well, Lake Wasota does have algae blooms, but they are not as pronounced. They're not as bad. The number of days that the lake is in bloom is less, and that's a function of a couple of things. One is there's less phosphorus loading into that lake, and another one is that lake, that river system has a little more staining in it, and that blocks light penetration. So more stain blocks some light, and that makes it a little harder for the algae to grow.
Okay. So what are some examples, Dan Zur, of some early attempts to remedy this? You know, I'm thinking of Mayor Randy Kanak of Menominee invented what he called a scum sucker. That's a more recent thing, but what were some of the early tries at fixing this?
Well, Paul's been around this neighborhood a whole lot longer than I have, so he can probably comment on that better than me.
Paul of Liberty?
Well, you don't have to look much farther than Half Moon Lake to look at attempts to fix a lake.
Right.
Actually, one of these EPA studies was done and approved on Half Moon Lake many years ago, I think in 2002. And you know, a lot of the attempts that people are familiar with in Half Moon Lake are implementing that plan. And those are in-lake solutions, which are chemical treatments. Mm-hmm. And but they were preceded by first cleaning up the watershed. There were a number of storm sewers that went into that lake that were diverted around it. So the first step is always clean up the watershed. And now in Half Moon Lake, they're going into the in-lake techniques to try to finish the job.
Which has had some mixed results. I mean, at first, I remember they treated it with aluminum sulfide or something. I can't remember the name of the chemical, but dumped tens of thousands of gallons in Half Moon Lake. And it was pretty interesting to watch it actually bind up, and then it was this weird crystal blue color. But then the way I understand it, or what I've read in the Leader Telegram, is that some of the aquatic life, the plants, the invasives, have come back a little bit.
Well, it's always interesting and educational when you try to manipulate Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And they had a lot of success with the alum treatment. The first year, the water was quite clear. I went out there and snorkeled in it, and it was pretty amazing. But what happened is it turns out the wells that they used to make up the water, mm-hmm. you know, that was lost when the storm sewers were diverted, has been increasing in its phosphorus content, the well water. And that's was an unforeseen wrinkle. And there are ways you can deal with that too, but it's just one more challenge in trying to get lakes as clean as we can make them.
And so, Dan Zur, why can't we just dump some alum in the Red Cedar River and have it kind of pool and bind up all that phosphorus and sink it to the bottom?
Well, what's interesting about Half Moon Lake is what we call an oxbow lake. It used to be the river. Mm-hmm. If you look at the shape of it, you can see it used to be a big bend in the Eau Claire River, and now it's a lake that really isn't fed much. That's why we pump well water into it, because there's nothing natural coming into it. And most of the storm water, the runoff from around the neighborhood around that lake, has been diverted or intercepted. The hospital over there has done some wonderful work in putting practices in on their property that grab the water coming off the buildings and the parking lots and infiltrate them to keep them from running off into the lake. So what we've done, the first step with Half Moon Lake was to stop the inputs of phosphorus. Because what alum does is alum sits on the top of the lake sediment. It locks up the phosphorus in the water column as it sinks down, and then it holds that phosphorus down in the sediment and makes it unavailable for the algae. The problem with lakes like Tainter and Monoman is there's a continuous inflow of phosphorus coming from the watershed. If we could stop that, if we could prevent all of the runoff from this huge watershed that's almost 2 million acres in size, if we could stop the size of that, or the flow of that phosphorus, we could then put some alum in that lake and take care of the phosphorus that was in the lake. But as long as there's more phosphorus coming in, that would settle on top of the alum.
It's kind of pointless.
It wouldn't do much good. It may be do good for a little while, but it wouldn't last very long.
And then as well, ideas like, you know, skimming the surface of the algae, that, again, is that just a temporary kind of a solution or even a pipe dream?
It, every little bit helps, and that would get some of the algae, which would take some of the phosphorus with it. You'd get some of that out of the water, and it's kind of a short-term, immediate, minor Band-Aid. But in the grand scheme of things, it really is not going to change the overall problem that we have with that lake, which is phosphorus inputs continually coming in and feeding the algae.
Paul of Liberty, when we see, I drive by and I'll see that the lake is green, but how far down does this algae go? How thick is the matting on top of the lake, or
well,
on the lakes?
You know, that's the aspect of blue-green algae. It tends to stay up near the surface, and it clouds the light out, and so it will impair the growth of plants, you know, rooted plants, which actually have habitat value for fish. So this, the shading effect is detrimental to the lake. And because they're up at the surface, they tend to blow around, and they accumulate in bays. Mm. And when they start to die, as they inevitably will, that's when the really obnoxious conditions that Dan described start to crop up. It gets its characteristic blue-green color. Some people think someone spilled paint on the lake. It's so bright and brilliant. And smells are associated with that. And also the production of algal toxins. And those are irritating some people that breathe it. We had a person who was working on the lake and who got some of it on her leg and got a rash from it.
Yeah.
And there have been reports of livestock and pets drinking the water from lakes like this who've died. So the toxins are dangerous.
And for the listeners at home, we're talking about a study aimed at reducing excess nutrients in the Red Cedar River, which contribute to some terrible outbreaks of blue-green algae in Tainter Lake and Lake Manoamin in Dunn County. We'll have more with our guests, Dan Zurr and Paula Liberty and Julia Olmsted, and we're going to talk about the TMDL, what it is and how it works and what we can expect it to do for the water quality in the Red Cedar and these lakes. This is the West Side. If you've got a question or a comment for our guests, give us a call. The number is 1-800-228-5615. You can also go to the West Side Facebook page and leave a comment or a question there. We'll be right back with more. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this hour. We're talking about a study prepared by the DNR and approved by the U.S. EPA to reduce excess nutrients in the Red Cedar River, which are leading to massive algae blooms in Tainter Lake and Lake Manoamin. I'm joined this hour by DNR Wastewater Field Supervisor Paul Liberty, Watershed Council Coordinator with UW Extension Julia Olmsted joins us by phone, and also joining us in studio is Regional Natural Resources Educator with UW Extension, Dan Zurr. We've got a couple calls coming in right now. If you'd like to get in on the conversation and let us know what you think about the conditions that that take place in summer and late summer on these lakes and what you think should be done or whether there should be more done to remedy the situation, give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615. That number, again, is 1-800-228-5615. Now, Paula Liberty, just before we get into this TMDL, which is basically a huge report with all kinds of suggestions, a lot of science, what are some of the regulations that are in place or have been in place for phosphorus in water? The way I understand it, it's phosphorus restrictions in Wisconsin on rivers and lakes is a new thing?
Well, actually, phosphorus restrictions go all the way back to the 1970s at their beginnings. That's when Wisconsin passed a regulation on laundry detergent. That was statewide. Also,
banning phosphorus from it?
Right, okay. Right, from laundry detergent. And we also started regulating the discharge of phosphorus into the Great Lakes from wastewater treatment plants. In 1992, that was expanded statewide to all the larger treatment plants had to treat to remove phosphorus. And that initiative had its birth really right in the Red Cedar Valley. Moving a little forward in time, in 1996 is when the lakes on the Red Cedar got listed as impaired with EPA, which then kicked off a chain of events. In 1997, Wisconsin passed its stormwater permitting program, and we now permit construction sites and other places like that, and that's why you see all these black silt fences all over the place to try to hold erosion in place, which controls phosphorus. So that happened in 97. In 2002, we established a minimum performance standards, which began to provide some standards for agriculture, among other things. In 2005, Taintra and Monoman Lake started to get posted with toxic algae signs, which isn't a regulation, but it certainly was a milestone locally.
Mm-hmm.
In 2008, Wisconsin required professional nutrient management for turf areas over 5 acres. That's golf courses and big parks. And then in 2010, several things happened. A restriction on sales of phosphorus and lawn fertilizer went into effect, and a lot of people maybe remember that because it's relatively recent.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that same year, a restriction on phosphorus in dishwasher detergent. Back in the 70s, there weren't that many dishwashers around. So now that's been affected. But finally, in December 2010, we had statewide standards for phosphorus that were passed. And that establishes the acceptable level for phosphorus all around the state. And those numbers influenced the development of the TMDL, which is a cleanup plan that we put together. And it's part of the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act, which is what Wisconsin administers here in the state. And it's sort of a multi-step process. The first step is to see what the conditions of your water bodies are. And if they're impaired, you list them with EPA. And I mentioned that it got listed. That obligates you to do a study.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a standard. What is the numerical standard? I mean, I don't want to get too bogged down in technical jargon, and the TMDL that I looked at is pretty full of all kinds of acronyms and weird numbers, but how do we measure it, and how do we know if there's too much per the state requirement?
Well, as you mentioned, there was a lot of science that went into developing those numbers, and I call them numbers because they vary by the water body. For example, there's a standard for the smaller streams that you could wade through. There's a different number for the bigger rivers. And then lakes are put into categories, and there's a different standard for the different types of lakes. You know, the northern lakes that don't have rivers flowing through them get a different number than larger lakes with rivers flowing through them. And so these standards are based on the point at which biology gets impacted, and they apply to all the water bodies in the state.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones right now. We've got Ron calling from Lake Monoman. And, Ron, you're on the air. What's on your mind? You got a question or a comment for our guests?
I'm on Lake Taintr.
Oh, I'm sorry, Lake Taintr. Okay.
Yeah, and I just wanted to express our appreciation to the DNR, Paul, and also your other guests for the work that they're doing on behalf of Lake Taintr and Lake Monoman. I'm the president of Taintr-Monoman Lake Association, and we recognize that this is a very complex problem, and we appreciate all of the work that Paul and his staff have done on behalf of our community here.
Mm-hmm.
One aspect that I don't know whether it has been completely explored is the health issues associated with Lake Taintr, Lake Monoman. There was some reference to it earlier, but Dunn County has received, or the state of Wisconsin has received, 26 health-related algae complaints from 2009 to 2011, and I guess I'd like to have a little more conversation about that, because we certainly do experience a tremendous problem with both human health issues and pet health issues as well on the lake.
Paula Liberty?
Well, there certainly are problems, and we have been cooperating both with the Dunn County Health Department and the Wisconsin State Division of Health on a health study. And we provide the water quality sampling, and they investigate the health claims. And one of the challenges we have is trying to figure out the threshold at which algae becomes so abundant that the health effects start. And that's through a cooperative study between us and the health departments that we can begin to develop that relationship. We know on Tainter and Monoman we're on the wrong side of whatever that line is, and we're trying to figure out where to set some acceptable thresholds so we can set good targets.
All right, Ron, there you go. Thanks for giving a call in. A reminder for all of our other listeners out there that you can join in the discussion about the Red Cedar River and excess nutrients and the algae bloom issues in Lake Tainter and or Tainter Lake and Lake Monoman. Right now, we're going to go back to the phones, and we've got Mike on the line. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I've been pretty much a lifelong Rice Lake resident. I live on the Red Cedar right now. I've lived here for about since 1995, but I've canoed and swam in the local lakes and rivers, you know, my whole life. I've seen, even up here, the lakes and rivers degrade, and in fact, I used to canoe the Red Cedar all the time, and I won't even go in it anymore because it's even up here, it's so weed-choked. And you have a chain of lakes here, starting with Big Chetek, then going through Birch, and then Balsam, and Red Cedar, and then Rice Lake, and the common thing I see about them is the shallow ones, like Big Chetek and Rice Lake, are really weed choke. Rice Lake, you can't even, if they didn't chop the weeds out in the summer, you couldn't even get a boat across it. So, you know, I would dearly love to see the whole chain be cleaned up if possible. I don't know where the problem starts, but I assume it all ties together. But does some of your plan cover these northern lakes where, you know, where the some of the, I'm sure, you know, your problem actually starts?
All right. Thanks for that. Again, Paula Liberty, please.
Well, the plan we developed, although it was targeted to Tainter and Monoman, the solution includes the whole watershed. And we know of the impairments that the caller mentioned. We know the weed choke situations in the Red Cedar, also in the Chetek River. And one of the things the plan calls for is a 65% reduction in the phosphorus load running through that system. And in order to get a 65% load reduction of, you know, that's pounds of phosphorus going into the lakes at the bottom end, you have to go all the way to the top and work your way down. And so that's going to mean going to all the areas with phosphorus sources and controlling them. And if we can meet the goals for Tainter and Monoman, we're going to see a lot of improvements in all the water bodies above it, especially the stretches of stream and river, because they're going to have to be a lot lower in phosphorus as a result.
All right. Well, there you go. Ken, did that answer your question?
You mean Mike?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. Yep. I was looking at the wrong
one. Yeah, good luck. I hope you can achieve it
all
in
right.
my lifetime. Yeah, thank you.
All right, take care. And we're moving right along here, and I want to talk a little bit about what the study found. The TMDL found that obviously there's too much nutrients, in particular phosphorus, going into the lake, and what it showed that there's point sources and non-point sources. And for people that don't understand what that is, Dan Zur, why don't you educate us a little bit on that? What is a point source?
Well, point sources are exactly that. There's something that can be traced to a specific point. Usually, it's like at the end of a pipe, a water treatment plant, wastewater treatment plant. Has an effluent pipe coming out of it. The water that goes down your sink that you flush down the toilet goes to the wastewater treatment plant. and that water gets treated, and the cleaner water that is the end product of that treatment process then gets usually ends up going back into a river downstream of the town that you live in, and that's the case in most of the communities around here. And there are factories that might have an effluent pipe, things like that, or a spill source where something is spilled. But non-point source, and to back up a little bit, point sources have been very well regulated over the years. The Clean Water Act did a really good job of putting some regulations in place where you could go and measure what was coming out of the end of that pipe, and you could go back into the facility and you'd say, there's too much of X, Y, or Z in your pipe, you have to get it out. Or you're going to be in trouble. And that has worked very well over the years. Non-point source pollution is stuff that's a little harder to characterize. It's flowing off a farm field. It's flowing off somebody's yard and down into the street and then down into the storm sewer and then down into a storm sewer outflow that's maybe going into a lake. So you can't pinpoint it quite as easily. And therefore, it's a little harder to control. And the regulations for non-point source pollution aren't nearly as stringent as they are for the point sources. It's much more, especially from an agriculture perspective, it's much more voluntary. It's like, well, we'll give you some money if you put in some practices, but we can't really force you to do a lot of this stuff. So that's the kind of the difference between the two.
And with that, let's bring Julia Olmsted into the discussion, because her role in this is to work with farmers. Julia, I noted that when I was reading through the TMDL and some of the other materials that were on these websites, that which are linked on the Westside Facebook page, I noticed that there's a quote, Wisconsin statutes require that farmer must be offered at least 70% cost sharing funds for BMP, which is best management practices installation, before they can be required to comply with the agricultural performance standards or prohibitions. Now, what kind of a monkey wrench does that throw into a plan like this?
Well, that's a good question. To be honest, as Dan just said, it's really hard to regulate and enforce a lot of reductions around non-point source pollution from agriculture. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And one is just because agriculture systems are really complicated and they change all the time. They're dynamic. There isn't, like Dan said, just sort of a pipe of phosphorus coming off of a field. And so for that reason, it's a difficult thing to tackle, no matter if you have a lot of money to throw at the solution or not. And it's something that isn't just, install a filter and take care of it one time. These are systems that are changing every year, where you have different effects from the different seasons. So it's really a problem that you have to be addressing constantly. And I think, to your question, I think I can talk a little bit, I think maybe it would be helpful if I talked a little bit about what we're trying to do with my position, which is a brand new project here in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. And why it's a little bit different than that idea of doing a cost share or providing a substantial amount of money to a farmer and then trying to do some more regulation. So, just briefly, my project is, like I said, a brand new project. We're piloting some really innovative watershed-based operations here in Northwest Wisconsin. We've got pilot watersheds in Dunn, Polk, Pierce, and St. Croix counties, and we're working with farmers in small sub-watersheds. So they're anywhere between about 15 to 20,000 acres. So maybe about 10 miles wide, give or take, mm-hmm. a couple miles. And what we're trying to do is to create leadership and engagement with the farmers themselves around water quality improvements. And my job is to create and facilitate farmer-led watershed councils. So this is really a new approach. It's a really innovative approach that the DNR is investing a lot in and really has a lot of hope for, that instead of the threat of regulation motivating farmers or throwing a lot of money with a one-time solution, that really this is going to be about farmers who know their systems, they know what works and what doesn't work on their fields, and really asking them to figure out and point to the things that they think can work and to become the leaders in the community around water quality improvements, to inspire other farmers to adopt new practices, mm-hmm. And to really, I would say, inspire their whole community to have a new ethic around water quality.
It sounds like these are all stakeholders, which is a word that comes up a lot in this study. Before we go any further, I wanted to ask Paul Liberty. Agriculture seems to be, or is assumed to be, at least in this study, or has been measured to be, the main cause for or the main source of this non-point solution. What percentage, I guess?
Well, the study that we did has two components. One is to figure out, you know, how the lake responds to phosphorus, and the other one goes up in the watershed and figure out where is it all coming from. And you need to know that before you can do anything about it. And so the study has identified, you know, where it's all coming from. And the point sources that Dan was talking about started out before all these rules passed that were about 7% of the load. And with the rules that we've passed in the last 20 years or so, they're down to less than 4% of the phosphorus load. By contrast, cropland is about two-thirds of the load. So that's why agriculture is important, and that's why the work that Julia is doing is important. And it isn't because, you know, farmers are bad stewards or anything. It's just that there's 300,000 acres of cropland in this watershed. I mean, just the size alone makes it important. And that's why it's important to work with farmers, because, you know, when they make a decision on land management, they're deciding on hundreds of acres. You know, when a property owner makes a decision, it's on a quarter of an acre, you know. So it's an acreage thing, and that's why farmers are so important, because they call the shots on most of the land in the watershed.
And with that, let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Ken on the line, and I believe he's got a comment relating to the whole source issue and how it relates to farmers or households.
Yes, it is.
You're on the air, Ken. Thanks.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Like Container Lake, I know everybody knows they've probably been grandfathered in, their sewer's going in there. You think that's the problem?
Okay, so, sewers, stormwater sewers, or Paul Liberty?
Well, are you talking?
No, it ain't stormwater. It's regular household sewer.
Okay. Do you have concerns that they're failing septic systems flowing into the lake?
Yeah, their septic systems going right into the lake.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we're advocating as part of this is everybody's got to do their share, and that includes all the property owners.
Yeah, but then why is everybody picking on the farmers about this phosphorus and stuff? You know what goes down the sewers. On regular toilets, you know, that's dumping right into the lake. So,
well, we did, as part of this study, do an estimate on the significance of the septic systems, not only around the lake, but adjacent to all the streams. And they're important, but compared to 300,000 acres of cropland, they're a minor contributor. And that doesn't mean they shouldn't be fixed, and they should be fixed. And it all has to be done.
So is the DNR picking on farmers here, or is that, I mean, is that an intention, or is it, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, what we're working on primarily now is the regulations on the people that hold permits with us. So, I mean, that's where the law says we have to spend most of our time. Our work with farmers is largely voluntary, and trying to work with projects like Julia's to get voluntary compliance. Our relationships with the cities and municipalities and the industries are regulatory in nature, and the septic system issue is also regulatory in nature, only at the county level.
Mm-hmm. Well, then how can they fix it?
Well, that has to be, like as Paul was saying, that has to be enforced by the counties. If something like that is happening, the county should enforce a failing septic system, especially if a septic system is failing to the point where raw sewage from the house is going straight into the lake. That's certainly a concern. If it's happening, you know, we want to address that as well. And that isn't DNR's purview. That's where the county comes in. There are different factors and different forces involved in not only enforcing regulations, but also in promoting solutions. And the one take-home message that I really want listeners to grasp is that this is a shared problem, and it's going to have to be a shared solution. there isn't really much more runoff and pollutants coming off an acre of residential property than there is an acre of agricultural land. The issue in this watershed is that we have so much more agricultural land than we have residential property that even if all the residential property, if all the urban runoff, if all this, the failing septic systems were cleaned up, it wouldn't fix the problem in this lake because there's just so much agricultural land that's producing runoff going into these lakes. And the problem isn't just the lakes in the Red Cedar Chain. We have this problem in other areas too. Mead Lake out in Clark County, along the Eau Claire River, Lake Eau Claire and Lake Altoona also have algae bloom issues. So everyone needs to take ownership of this and figure out what they can do with the land that they manage to help come up with solutions for this problem.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for the call and the reminder to the other listeners that might want to get in the conversation. The number is 1-800-228-5615. And I wanted to go back to the farmer-led councils and to Julia Olmsted. How are these picked, and do they have any regulatory authority or any enforcement authority, or is it just kind of neighbors encouraging neighbors?
Yeah, no, there's no regulatory or enforcement authority that is or will go on associated with these. These watersheds were picked for a couple of reasons. One is because they all impact waterways that are in trouble. They all contribute to those waterways and to those water quality problems. And additionally, they were picked by the county conservation staff themselves from the Lake and Water Districts they really tried to look for sub watersheds that had farmers that were already active in whether it's working with county staff on conservation activities or just a strong civil structure. Basically, they didn't want a watershed that didn't already have farmers that were likely to engage and to be a part of this process. Like I said, these are pilot areas, so we're really trying to see what we can do, how it can be of value to the farmers. There is no regulatory intent. It's really just giving power and actually some authority to the farmers in the way of a pool of money to incentivize good practices and really to show off to neighbors what you can do when you start to adopt some of these best management practices.
We're talking about a study released by the DNR, approved by the EPA, that is aimed at reducing excess nutrients, particularly phosphorus, in the Red Cedar River, and with the overall goal of reducing obnoxious algal blooms in Lakes Manoman and Tainter. This is the West Side. We'll be right back with more from our guests, including Dan Zurr and Julia Olmsted of UW Extension and Paul Liberty of the DNR. We've got a couple calls waiting to get on the line, and we will work through them as best we can with the time that is allowed. You're listening to the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking this hour about a hefty study done by the DNR, approved by the EPA. The goal is to reduce excess nutrients in the Red Cedar River Basin and ultimately kill off some algae or keep algae blooms from overtaking Lakes Manoman and Tainter. We've got three guests on the program. We've got Dan Zurr and Julia Olmsted, both of UW Extension, and Paul Liberty of the DNR. And we've got some calls that we're going to work through in just a bit here. But first, I wanted to quickly go back to Julia Olmsted. And we were talking about, you mentioned earlier, some pilot watersheds. And there was a pilot program in the town of Grant. Could you tell us quickly about that? And is that like a precursor to this farmer-led council?
Boy, I'm going to have to see if Dan or Paul can speak to that. I am not familiar with that, and I have to say, caveat, I'm very new to this position. So,
okay.
Dan, do you know about that?
Yeah, this started up several years ago. Dunn County Land Conservation and River Country Resource Conservation and Development District teamed up to work with farmers in the town of Grant, just to the north of Colfax. And what they did is they surveyed the farmers to try to figure out what the farmers knew about the water quality issues on the red cedar and what they were willing to do and some reasons perhaps why they weren't willing to do certain things. And they tried to design a project where they got the farmers to participate in some practices or some monitoring on their property, soil testing to see what the phosphorus content was in their soil, things like that. And then they made available, they rented a some no-till planting equipment, and they made that available to the farmers. And the farmers tried no-till cropping, which basically leaves a whole bunch of plant residue from the previous year on the surface of the soil so the soil doesn't erode away when water hits it. No-till is a good method in some, it doesn't work on every farm, but it's a good method on some farms to help keep soil and phosphorus in place. And they were pretty successful in that project, earning Farmers Trust and getting farmers to try this technique. And it saves farmers a little bit of input money. They don't have to make so many passes with a disc to till up the soil, so it saves them fuel cost. Hmm. And most of the farmers out there found that their yields were as good, if not better, than they were with conventional tillage. And it was fairly successful.
Cool. Back to the phone lines. We're going to go to Colfax for this one. Jim, you're on the line, or on the air, excuse me. Did we lose Jim? Well, he had a question about shed runoff. I guess I can't really speak to that. I'm not sure what he was getting at. Paul of Liberty, maybe manure storage or something runoff. Any is that addressed at all in the TMDL?
Well, cropland is identified as a big source, and how you manage manure is part of managing cropland. And manure storage is a technique that is becoming more common, where in the wintertime the manure is stored, and so it can be spread on the fields when they aren't snow-covered and frozen, mm-hmm. because it's pretty well known that when that snow melts, some of that manure goes with it. So, that is a common management technique that will help.
All right. And one of the other callers that we had on the line that couldn't stick with us wants to know how we get more information about these studies. Dan Zur, where can they go?
Well, DNR has good information on their website about TMDLs and about phosphorus and algae issues. There is a Red Cedar website that is on an extension server, and if people can write this down really quick, it's naturalresources.uwex.edu/redcedar, and that's the page that has a lot of information. And we've got a conference coming up on March 14th, the second year that we've done this. Last year was the first initial Red Cedar Conference, and we're going to do it again this year, coming up on March 14th at UW-Stout. It's an all-day event. 8:30 till about 4 o'clock. There's going to be some great speakers sharing a lot of information about things that have been done on the Red Cedar, information about the TMDL. Paul will actually be there talking about that. Some more information from Paul McGinley, a professor at UW-Stevens Point, talking about research. We're going to have some information for farmers and a good discussion with farmers that have participated in some of these best management practices that we're talking about, and they can share their firsthand experience. Julia, who's with us on the phone, is going to be there as well. There's going to be a lot of good information, a lot of networking, and just a lot of community building. That's one of the things about these kinds of projects. When you're trying to solve any environmental project, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get people to change something that they do, and they're not very amenable to that unless you earn their trust. And building community and getting people to talk to each other and understand each other and understand each other's issues is a good way to start with a lot of this, and there's going to be a lot of that going on at the conference as well. So that's March 14th at UW-Stout. Please come if you can.
Now, I'll finish up here with a quick question to all three of you. I'll start with Julie Olmsted. We've got the plan, we've got the paper, we've got the roadmap, really. Is there any timeline, and how, I mean, is it realistic to think that we can actually fix this?
Well, you know, I think it is realistic that we can fix it, but change takes a long time. And, you know, the work that we're doing right now with the farmers and the watersheds I think that, you know, it's not going to take long, a couple of years, to really start to see phosphorus reductions coming off the field, because I think that we're going to be pretty successful with this.
All right.
But that said, that doesn't mean it's going to make the algae go away in 2 years on Taylor Lake or Lake Monoman either. So people are going to have to be patient.
And very quickly, Paula Liberty, your thoughts?
Well, I agree with Dan that this is going to be a community effort. Since everyone's contributing, we all have to do our part.
And Dan Zier?
Definitely. It's a shared problem. It needs shared solutions. And if you want to learn more, come to the conference. Check out the website. We're here for you.
March 14th at UW Stout?
March 14th at Stout, yes.
All right. Well, thank you all for being with us. Our guests, Julie Olmsted of UW Extension, Dan Zier of UW Extension, and Paula Liberty of the DNR. Thank you so much. Thanks to the callers for being part of the program as well. And next week, we're going to be on a brief hiatus for the West Side, but we'll be back the week after for a discussion about poverty in schools as measured by free and reduced lunches at the school districts, which has gone up quite a bit over the past years. I'm Rich Kramer. This is the West Side. Thanks so much for listening.